Women in Crime is a true crime podcast hosted by real criminologists.
Each episode will bring you a new female-focused case deconstructed by experts. You'll hear the stories of these women paired with the science that tells us where it all began.
Listen and learn why on Women in Crime. Listen to Women in Crime now wherever you get your podcasts.
So today, we're going to uncover the shocking truth behind one of the most notorious arsonists in American history. Meet John Orr, the man who lived a double life as a respected firefighter, as well as a dangerous pyromaniac, from his humble beginnings as a volunteer to his eventual downfall as the pyro cop. This gripping tale will leave you on the edge of your seat, but the question still remains: what drives a firefighter to set deadly fires? And was John Orr just a tragic exception, or the product of a deeper issue in the firefighting community? Well, today we're going to find out, and the truth will surprise you. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Casual Criminalist. I'm your host, Simon. If you're new to the show, what happens here? One of my writers, Kevin, in this case, has written me an episode all about John Leonard Orr, apparently a firefighter who sets fires. What are you up to, John? Don't be doing that. That's like a murderous cop. Those don't exist. Oh, I kid. The four men, I've never read this before. You and I, dear listener, we're going to go on a little journey of exploration together, so shall we just jump in then? Being a firefighter is often a thankless and underpaid job. I don't mean to already comment, we're not even one line in. That is half a line. But aren't firefighters thanked quite a lot? I feel like firefighters are thought of as heroes, aren't they? Especially, I feel like in American culture, firefighters are like, they're there saving our lives and getting our cats out of trees, yes? And yeah, maybe they're underpaid, but also don't they get to retire at like 50? Which, that sounds pretty dope. I mean, like 14 years to retirement and I barely feel like I've started my career. You know what I mean? That feels like, you know, reward. Although I guess they do die young because of all of the firefighting. It's so underpaid that of the 1.2 million firefighters in the United States, about 71% of them are volunteers who aren't even on the payroll. Is that? I mean, okay, that feels like a dodgy statistic, though. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to interrupt this much throughout this episode, I promise you. That feels like a dodgy statistic, because you'll be like, yeah, okay, there's 10 volunteers, but they all volunteer like 1 hour a week. Is that based on number of hours put in? Because they're also probably not as effective as, you know, fully trained regular firefighters, right? And also you're volunteering. That doesn't mean, you know, there's a big difference between volunteering and getting paid nothing for a job that you don't want to do. If you're volunteering, it's out of your own choice, probably because you get your money from elsewhere, or I don't know, you won the lottery or something, I don't know. You do you. After serving in World War II, one of my grandfathers spent the rest of his life working as a firefighter in the city of Boston. When he reached retirement after decades of service, all he had to show for it was a relatively small two-family home that my grandparents shared with my great-aunt and uncle, who had some crippling back pain that meant I never saw him stand upright in my life. Yeah, I mean, firefighting, that is a hard job. That's gonna, like, you're gonna do yourself some damage. That last part's also extremely common because of all the heavy stuff that they have to constantly carry around. Despite being a job that literally requires you to charge into flaming buildings, over half of all on-the-job injuries for firefighters are back injuries. But even after the low pay and a broken back, I don't think he had any complaints. Unfortunately, not everybody is happy doing a thankless job, even if they're getting paid for it. For many, the point of being a public servant isn't to spend a 24-hour shift quietly keeping people safe. It's to be celebrated as a goddamn hero. Okay, I feel like most people are probably somewhere in between. It's like, yeah, okay, I'll spend 24 hours keeping people safe, but if someone tells me that I'm a hero for saving their dog, I'm not going to be like, no, do not call me a hero. I'll be like,
thank you.
Thank you, yes. Yes, I am. Yes. It has long been established that police officers and criminals are two sides of the same coin. They have similar personality traits and motivations, and roughly 1,100 police officers are convicted of various types of crimes every year. Though not nearly as well known, there's actually a link between firefighters and arson as well. The link is a bit different, and I'm not suggesting there is a correlation between the psychology of firefighters and arsonists. Firefighter arson is generally the result of either sheer boredom or hero syndrome. Hero syndrome is a term that was coined by the media to describe someone who creates a potentially dangerous situation that they have the ability to resolve in the hopes that they'd be lauded as a hero. Yeah, I feel that's fairly obvious. Okay. In fact, media coverage of firefighter arson is one of the main reasons the phrase hero syndrome even exists, and roughly 100 firefighters are arrested for arson in the United States every year. I guess that feels like a lot, why 1,100 cops were arrested for crimes. Or convicted of crimes? Was that arrested or convicted? Convicted. Oh, my Lord. Okay. So a lot more arrested and not convicted. But because arrest to conviction is not that high of a ratio. Unless you're in Japan. In Japan, it's like 99% or something insane. So if you get arrested in Japan, they're damn sure you did it and you're going to go to jail or be hung. Because I think they still hang people in Japan for if they've committed a capital offense, which is fairly intense. They have this hanging room where there's like a trapdoor on the floor and it opens up like in the olden days. Japan, what's wrong with, like, why do we have, even America, why do we have to kill people in weird ways? What's wrong with, like, I always think, if I had to be executed for committing all my horrible crimes, I'll be like, I don't know, firing squad, gas would be pretty up on my list. Lethal injection would not be up there. Hanging, definitely not. No. Good Lord. Now, the link is a bit different, and I'm not suggesting there is a correlation between the psychology of firefighters and arsonists. Firefighting, usually the fires they set are small. It may be a run-of-the-mill dumpster fire or a tiny brush fire, something that won't actually be dangerous, but it will give them something to do instead of sitting around the fire station all day. That works well enough for those who are simply bored, but for the firefighters that are suffering from hero syndrome, there needs to be something bigger. In order to be a hero, there needs to be some actual danger, like a building that was set on fire while it was still filled with people. While that could theoretically lead people to believe that the arsonist was a hero after they came back to save the day, there's a great chance that they'll just wind up being a murderer. Oh my God. Yeah, there's a big difference between like setting a dumpster fire, so people are like, oh my God, you did it. Look, you saved us. And then like setting a shopping mall on fire or something. I mean, don't do either, but they're obviously, it's not one of those things where it's like, they're all bad. It's like, well, they are all bad, but one is obviously worse. The early life of John Orr. John Leonard Orr was born on the 26th of April 1949 in Los Angeles, California. For most part, he had a pretty ordinary childhood. His father owned a sporting goods store. He had two brothers, and everything was great until he was 16 years old, or at the very least, there doesn't seem to be any indication that he was being abused or killing animals. When John was 16, his mother went to visit her family in Missouri and told them that she'd call in a few days. She never called, and she didn't return to LA for 3 years, at which point she still never came back to see John's father. So I guess things must have not been that great for his mother to essentially go out for a pack of smokes and never come home, but there doesn't seem to be any evidence for what caused her decision. That feels a little bit... I don't want to be a dude saying that it's sexist towards men, but if this was the genders were the other way around and the dude just left, it would be like he just abandoned his kids because he's a dick. Women can also abandon their kids. They don't have to be... I think Evan's implying there was something that made her leave, like that wasn't her fault. Maybe she just left because she didn't want to raise her kids anymore. I'm sure that happens, probably much less than with men, but it probably still happens, doesn't it? Is that okay to say? I don't know. We live in a world where it's very, you know, you gotta think twice as a content creator about like saying something that's sexist or like, you know what I mean? What a world. During his senior year of high school, John attended the school's career day. He had long dreamed of being a police officer, but at career day, he spoke with a captain in the LA Fire Department. The idea of becoming a firefighter fascinated him, and the captain's advice was that he should join the military and get his training in fighting fires there. That seems like a weird path to take since firefighting academies exist, but it was enough to convince John. The guy at the career center, does he know what he's doing? He's like, no, you should join the military.
Because I looked it up on Google and it said that I should join a firefighting academy. They exist.
And he's like, the military, son. That's the place for you. I remember when I went to my first careers day and there was someone there who did YouTube and they were like, that is the not really. Not really. Careers days, I don't know. I don't really remember much about them. I know they existed. I know they happened, but I can't recall a single thing about them. It would be usually just people's parents had come in and they'd be like, I do this job. And you'd be like,
cool.
Okay. That sounds interesting. But I mean, we were like 16, 17. What are we supposed to do? Like make big decisions about our career? I guess we had to, because then like you go to university to study something. I feel like I was definitely at that stage. I'm sorry, I'm just rambling so much today. I will rein it in, I promise. I feel like I was at that stage where there was like that crossover between you didn't have to study, you didn't have to do what you studied at university. Like for a long time it was like, yeah, you study at university and then you do the career that you studied at university. But I kind of came up in that careers thing where it was switching and people started switching jobs a lot more and changing careers and... Yeah, I mean, that's what happened to me, isn't it? I'm just joking, I never had a career. And that, look, I'm going to rein it in. You'll see. Following high school, he enlisted in the U.S. Air Force, and after basic training, he was transferred to the Air Force Firefighting School in 1967. John got married to his high school sweetheart, Jody, and the two went to Spain, where he had been stationed. It was here that he would suffer his first great disappointment. In the 3 years he spent in Spain, only two planes crashed on the runway. I don't think that's disappointing. Like, that's what you want. You want it to be boring. Like, my cousin's in the Air Force, and or was in the Air Force. Maybe he's out of the Air Force now. And I swear, like, most of his career, I don't really know. We don't know each other very well. I just, you know, speak to him at family gatherings or whatever. My feeling was he worked in, like, the post office of the Air Force for, like, most of his enlistment or whatever you call it. That's what he seemed to do. He seemed to sort mail for people in the Air Force. So, okay, fine. I guess John hadn't really considered this, but Air Force pilots tend to be extremely well trained before being allowed to fly an actual plane, and they're really good at what they do. Military personnel may be highly expendable, but those planes are expensive as f**k, so the Air Force is not going to let someone take off without adequate training. While many people would still see this as a good thing, for John, it was excruciatingly boring. Also, just pilots, like fighter pilots, they're also extremely expensive. Like, outside of Kevin's joke about whether the military cares about life or not, or Kevin's ponderings rather than joke, pilots are really expensive because that training's really expensive. So they're worried about the plane and the pilot. I wonder how much it costs to train a pilot. It's got to be millions of dollars, right? I can't find any hard numbers on this other than the quantity of firefighting arsonists, but his disdain for the lack of emergencies to address isn't uncommon. When I was a lifeguard, I was of the opinion that a boring day was a good day, but as far as I can tell, mine was the minority opinion. While people in potentially life-saving jobs don't want others to actually die, it seems the majority want people to come close enough to dying that it makes their job important. I mean, or at least not boring. I kind of get that. If I was a lifeguard, you're just sitting there in that chair all day, just being like, you know, in your brain, where it's like, you can't listen to a podcast, you can't read, because you got to watch if people are, like, drowning quietly. You're just, I'd be like, oh, for fuck's sake, come on, someone, just drown a little bit. Don't drown very much. Like, don't get to the point where I have to, like, give you the kiss of life or something like that. But just, like, just a little bit. Just be like, oh, I've got to dive in the pool with my clothes on right now. Or maybe do, like, a slow run to the pool as I take off my shirt. You know, that kind of stuff. In 1970, John was transferred to a base in Montana, where he stayed for another year before being honorably discharged. Much to his disappointment, there was only one fire that he had to put out during that year. While his military service hadn't been the action-packed firefighting experience he hoped for, he did learn a valuable lesson from it. John hated his commanding officers, and really anyone in a position of authority. He felt these people were stupid, arrogant, condescending assholes who exploited their power to compensate for their own insecurities after leaving duty. If you don't want to be bossed around, you shouldn't join the military. I'm sorry, like, or get a job or do anything where someone's like, but the getting bossed around, that's kind of what the military is. After leaving the Air Force, he decided to go back to his previous dream of being a police officer, because if anyone was going to be a stupid, arrogant, condescending arsehole trying to compensate for their own insecurities, it was going to be him. John applied to two police departments, also applying to two firefighting departments as a backup. But anyone who's ever applied for a government job, even at the local level, can tell you that they take an absolute eternity to hear back from. During this wait, he and Jody had a daughter, and after his daughter was born, John finally got a chance at his dream. He was invited to test for the LAPD. John passed all the tests with flying colors, except for one, the mental health screening. Oh god, that's an important one. He was deemed mentally unsuitable for duty. Not wanting to give up, he hired his own psychiatrist to administer these tests. While his psychiatrist said that he was suitable to be a police officer, the LAPD weren't interested in being given a second opinion. He then had the opportunity to test for the LA Fire Department. This time, his mental stability wasn't called into question. It's possible that it may have been, but it never came to that, as he failed both the written and physical exams. Getting desperate, he applied to the Glendale Fire Department, the lowest paying fire department in the county. It was there in 1974 that he was finally given a job as a firefighter. For anyone keeping track, that is 3 years between leaving the military and getting this job. Wait. I don't know what Kevin means by that. Is that just because he was unemployed for that whole time? Surely he had to make money doing something. Do you get a military pension? Do you get money every month if you've served in the military and then you leave the military? Is that what a military pension is? Or is a military pension just something that you get extra when you get old and get to normal retirement age? I have no idea. Let's just carry on. I'm assuming you must have made ends meet somewhere. You must have had some jobs, just not the jobs you wanted. and worked in a store or whatever. Let me interrupt today's video to tell you about our fantastic sponsor, Shopify. Shopify allows your dreams to become a reality. Look, whether you're selling succulents or stilettos, Shopify simplifies selling online and also in person with their POS systems, by the way, so you can focus on successfully growing your business, which, as I say, that's where business owners should be focused, not on what am I going to use to sell stuff, but on the bigger picture stuff. When it comes to the answer of where should you sell stuff, it's Shopify, obviously, today's fantastic sponsor. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform, which even lets you sell across social media marketplaces like TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram, packed with industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth. Shopify gives you complete control over your business and your brand without having to learn any new skills in design or coding. And as I understand it, those are skills which take a while to develop, so that's good. You can customize your online store to your style, connect with new customers to drive growth, and even maintain the relationships that will keep them coming back, no matter how big you want to grow. And thanks to 24/7 help and an extensive business course library, Shopify is there to support your success every step of the way. So now it's your turn to get serious about selling and try Shopify today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/casual. Go to shopify.com/casual to take your business to the next level today. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. And now back to today's show. Let me interrupt today's video to tell you about Rocket Money. Look, the average person has around 12 paid subscriptions. Oh God, are we including like business subscriptions in that? No, even if we're including personal subscriptions, I am so desperately above 12, it's not even funny. Look, think about that. God, I'm the perfect customer for this, aren't I? Like, I didn't even think about this. And then it gets out of control, and then you check your bank statements, and you're like, oh my God, what is going on in my life? Who is this person charging me, like $7 a month? And you're like, I don't even know what this is anymore. It just comes from some, like, generic company name that you've never heard of. And you're just like, what is that? Just cancel it, please. Well, Rocket Money is here to help you do that. What they do is they help you identify and cancel all of your unwanted subscriptions. Rocket Money, previously known as Truebill, is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills all in one place. God, they do even more than I thought they did. That's brilliant. Over 80% of people have subscriptions they forget about. Is it only 80%? I feel like that stat should be like 99%, but obviously the talking points say it's 80. I just feel it's got to be higher, hasn't it? There's so many that we subscribe to and then we forget about. Yeah, it's like that streaming service that you bought to watch one show and then you forgot about it. Rocket Money will quickly and easily identify your subscriptions for you so you can stop paying for the ones that you don't want. Simply find the subscription you don't want, press cancel, and Rocket Money will cancel it for you. No more long hold times with customer service or tedious emails back and forth. Rocket Money makes canceling subscriptions as easy as the click of a button. I tried to cancel something the other day. It wasn't a subscription, it was just like a membership to something. And they were like, yeah, just email support. I'm like, what are you talking about? No! Email support to cancel something? That should be illegal. Over 3 million people have used Rocket Money, saving the average person up to $720 a year, which is extraordinary. Stop throwing your money away. Cancel unwanted subscriptions and manage your expenses the easy way by going to rocketmoney.com/casual. That's rocketmoney.com/casual. rocketmoney.com/casual. $720 a year. The average. That means there's someone, for every person who's not doing this and hasn't, you know, doesn't have any unwanted subscriptions, there's someone who has, like, on the other side of that curve, who has, like, thousands of dollars a year. I realize I'm probably that person. Rocket Money! Back to the show. The Wannabe Cop. John began his job at the Glendale Fire Department, but he found the schedule rather boring. The most common schedule for firefighters to work is a 24-hour shift and then have the next 48 hours off. But what was John supposed to do on his 4 to 5 days off from work each week? Be a loving husband and father to his family? No, f*** that noise. He had better things to do, like work part-time at a 7-Eleven. Well, that's not too bad. I thought it was going to be like, he's, you know, going to go to do something, like, not unsavory or whatever, but just, like, laze off or pretend he's working or this kind of stuff. It's not bad to have a second job to support your family. Also, I have to say, I've never done it, so I don't really know, but I would much rather work a 20, like, say, 2 24-hour shifts a week than do 5 days 9 to 5. And I know it's more hours to do the 48 hours or 2 24s, But you're still going to be able to sleep. They just might interrupt your sleep to go out and, you know, do some firefighting. And I'm not saying I want to be a firefighter because, you know, that's scary. But if there was a job, like, I don't know, medicine or something, where it's like you do 22, 24-hour shifts a week, I would much rather do that. I'd take that any day. At least I think I would. While working at 7-Eleven, John became friends with a female co-worker. The two decided to get an apartment together, so he left a note for Jodie and just disappeared. Yeah, I was like, oh, isn't this guy married? Doesn't he have kids? Okay. Similar to what his mother had done to his family. He and his new girl eventually got married. If you're wondering if he was some really good-looking guy that was able to have all the women he wanted, the answer is no. John basically looked like the BTK killer's chubby brother, which might be your thing, but by conventional standards, he would not be considered attractive. John also began studying fire science at a local college and got another job working at Sears as a security guard. He was inspired to take this job after catching a shoplifter at 7-Eleven, and it was a job that he took entirely too seriously. Despite being good at catching shoplifters, he took a lot of unnecessary risks that would get a security guard fired today. He would chase shoplifters far outside of the store and even got into physical fights with them. Oh my god. The shops must love him. No, they wouldn't love him. Maybe they loved him back in the day, but today I'd be like, yo, I stole from your store and your security guard beat the shit out of me. I'm suing you for a million. Which I feel like wouldn't be an outrageous news story to read today, which is insane. But back in the day, maybe they were just more chill with us. Eventually, he got a carry permit so he could have a gun, something that is definitely not necessary or allowed at a department store security job. No, dude, security guards should not have guns unless you work for like Securitas, like carrying money around in like dangerous countries. Around both the fire department and the police department, John got a reputation of being a wannabe cop. He got this reputation because it was accurate. At the police station, they also referred to him as Inspector Clouseau. For anyone unfamiliar with the Pink Panther movies, this is not a compliment. But despite the excitement of bullying teenagers who were trying to shoplift sneakers or whatever, John was bored at the fire station. The alarm rarely went off and he couldn't stand just sitting around waiting anymore. He wound up getting transferred to Hill Patrol, which is pretty much exactly what it sounds like. His job was to drive around looking at hills and vacant lots to make sure that they weren't on fire. A big part of the job was telling people to clear their brush and to write citations for those who didn't clear their brush properly. Needless to say, he wrote an abnormally high amount of citations. He did manage to apprehend some people who were trying to commit arson, but he also apprehended people for unrelated crimes just because he thought that he could. John wound up leaving his second wife for a girl he worked with Sears at that then became his third wife. The marriage didn't last long and he began actively dating, gaining a reputation as a womanizer. It was also around this time that he was invited to apply to become an arson investigator.
Uh-oh.
Can see where this is going, given the title of this episode. This time around, he passed the mental health screening and received the promotion. Yeah, I mean, can't you, like, I don't know, those mental health screenings. I've taken one once, like, in my life. I used to do these, like, when I was a kid, like, at university or whatever. You could do these, I did these things where you test, like, experimental drugs for lots of money. And I remember going to one of them, and they had like a mental health screening before you did it because I was guessing it's some sort of drug that could affect your brain. I don't even remember. I didn't look that much into it. I was just like, sure, I'll take the pills. How much are you paying me? And that's how I ended up how I am. Sorry. The episode was interrupted. A FedEx man came and I'm pretty sure they're probably not sponsoring this episode. But I just got a new pair of Vessies. I mean, I save until after I've done this episode. It's going to be something to look forward to. Love me some Vessies. What was I talking about? Oh yeah, I took this psychological... One of them was he had to take the psychological test. And I mean, it was really obvious what the right answers were supposed to be. So you're just like, yeah, that answer. You can't help but cheat because they're like, I can't remember what the questions were, but it was very obvious. It was very obvious. The job was a backup dream come true. All of his silver medal fantasies finally reality. You see, as an arson investigator, John was technically considered a law enforcement officer and was allowed to carry a firearm at all times. But despite having the same technical classification, it wasn't the same thing as being a real police officer. He was paired with the police officer in his work, and the officer would constantly mock him for not being a real cop and give a shit for carrying a gun, saying that there was no reason he needed one. Oh, savage. Even though the two didn't get along, you could get along. I think because I'm a dick, I'll just be ribbing someone like this thinking it's all good natured. They'll be like, I actually find it very offensive and I've hated you for years. And I'll be like, oh, sorry. Jeez, calm down, mate. Even though the two didn't get along, they were successful at catching a number of arsonists. John was also becoming much more financially successful. Glendale had gone from being the lowest paying fire department in the country to one of the highest paid, thanks to joining a union. However, something strange started happening once John was promoted. Glendale saw a massive spike in the number of arsons being committed. According to John, this was just an illusion. He claimed that the quantity of arsons hadn't actually increased. He was just so goddamn good at his job that he was able to identify incidents as arson that would have otherwise been ruled as an accident. accident, brush fire that was believed to be caused by drought or lightning. Oh no, 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 that's arson. Old building that caught fire, allegedly due to faulty wiring. Also arson. The kid over there jaywalking. Yes, that is arson. Even if he was right, the number of arson investigations was alarming. But one fire in particular was far more alarming than the others. 1984 South Pasadena Fire. On October the 10th, 1984, a major fire broke out at Ohl's Home Center, an 18,000 square foot hardware store inside a shopping plaza in South Pasadena. The fire quickly spread and the entire building was destroyed. Unfortunately, not everybody was able to make it out. Trapped inside the building was 17-year-old store employee Jimmy Satina, a 26-year-old mother of two, Carolyn Krause, 50-year-old Ada Deal, and her 2-year-old grandson, Matthew Triodel. Dude, if you set this fire, you're going to prison forever, bro. That is so many people. Arson investigators from all over Southern California came to investigate the scene. All of them agreed that it was an accidental electrical fire, with the exception of John. Not only did John insist that it was arson, he was furious that everybody else believed the fire was an accident. Oh, okay, so he didn't set this one. Good. Oh, God. That would be terrible. But I get the feeling we might be going in that direction. This is the Casual Criminalist, after all. Like, people are gonna die from someone else's hand, usually. Further investigation showed that John was correct, but this was a common theme. Wait, so he is actually really good at this detecting stuff. Oh, God, but then did he actually set it? Does he know? Because he set it, and he's looking so big brain, even to me for a second, because I'm smooth brain. He was... Oh, that's crazy, John. John, what are you up to? Fires are extremely common in California, especially when the Santa Ana winds, sometimes called the devil winds, are present. These hot, dry winds can turn the entire area into a tinderbox and frequently result in wildfires. It would be easy for lots of various brush fires and other events to be chalked up to California's dry season. Luckily, they had their expert arson investigator to set that record straight. Though the amount of arsons that John was identifying seemed to be increasing at an alarming rate and nobody was actually being arrested for the fires, John remained clear of all suspicion. The following year, in 1985, he got married to his fourth wife. Like I said, he was not a particularly attractive guy, and he doesn't seem very charming. More like he'd be a giant pain in the ass to deal with, so I really don't know how he kept pulling this off. Maybe his newest wife was just starstruck after seeing John on TV so many times. Whenever a fire broke out, he was always on hand to speak to newspaper reporters, sit down for television interviews, and he even wrote a number of magazine articles about the rash of fires. Things were going great for John. He had a new wife, a couple of daughters. He was finally being viewed as the hero investigator he had longed to be. Whenever he appeared on the news, he was seen as always being calm, while reassuring that people were safe and investigators were doing everything possible to catch the arsonists. Wait, except they never did. He was like, it's arson. My job is done. And then the police were like, we have no idea who did this and there's no evidence. So they're still out there. And John's like, everyone is safe. John, what are you talking about, John? They clearly weren't, but people felt safe, as he was viewed as an expert in arson investigator by both the public and his colleagues. People were not very logical. Unfortunately for John, he was also an idiot, or a narcissist, or probably both. Either way, he was about to fly too close to the sun. In January 1987, he attended a convention for arson investigators in Fresno, California. The conference began during the day. Then that night, a drug store nearby was set on fire. An hour later, another fire broke out at a fabric store across the street. One block away, a fire broke out in a dried flower section of a craft shop, but investigators were able to find the incendiary device that set this blaze. The device was a makeshift fire starter, utilizing a number of matches attached to a lit cigarette using a rubber band, and it was wrapped in a piece of yellow-lined notebook paper. A single fingerprint was pulled from the piece of paper, but there weren't any matches in the rather antiquated system. It's a bit of a massive coincidence. There's a convention for arson investigators. There's three fires surrounding the convention center. You're going to be like, whoever's at that? It's one of those investigators. Because you know the cop thing, like cops and criminals, two sides of the same coin. And people must be vaguely aware of the arson thing and the firefighter thing. They're going to be like, it's one of these arson dudes, isn't it? I suppose it could be someone taunting them. That could also be possible. This method of starting fires was the signature of the arsonist that would be given the nickname the Pillow Pyro because of his fondness for starting fires in the linen section of stores where they would spread more quickly. He was also given the nickname the Frito Bandito, a name shared with the vaguely racist cartoon mascot for the Fritos corn chips, though where on earth this latter nickname came from continues to elude me. I have no idea what the mascot looks like. I don't know Fritos. I don't think we get Fritos in Europe. On the last day of the convention, more fires broke out across Bakersfield, California. Captain Marvin Casey, of the Bakersfield Fire Department began to suspect, based on the notebook paper resembling the type used by investigators, that the arson was in fact the work of one of the people at the convention. That guy's got his big brain in gear. Witness statements were taken from people at various stores that had been set fire to, but nobody could agree on a description of the culprit. All that could be determined, for sure, was that he was male. While the notebook paper gave Captain Casey his suspicions, it wasn't enough to go on. Maybe the arsonist was unrelated to the convention. After all, it's not like a normal civilian would have any idea that an arson investigator's convention was a thing that existed, let alone something that was going on in the neighboring town. It could have just been coincidental and questionable timing on the part of some third party. Sure, that might make sense. I get the feeling that's sarcasm, right? It's definitely related to the arson convention. That is until the same thing happened again at the next convention in March 1989, held in Pacific Grove, California. Six more fires were set nearby the second convention, and there was no longer any way this could be seen as a coincidence. The arsonist had to be one of the investigators that attended both conferences, and he had a massive ego to think that he could get away with this. There were only 10 people that had attended both conferences, and John immediately fell under suspicion as he was one of those 10. Unfortunately, all 10 people's fingerprints were checked against the one found in 1987, and none were a match. Okay, how does that work? John returned home without ever being investigated further. The Pillow Pyro Task Force. Instead of John being investigated more thoroughly, he was promoted to the rank of captain. As an arson investigator, he was no longer doing 24-hour shifts like he did as a firefighter. Now that he was captain, he only had to work 4 days per week and had a salary of over $65,000 per year, which is over double that in today's money. That's $130,000. I know Americans get paid a lot, but that's a lot, right? Even in like California, that's a good salary. That's like well into the six figures. And he only works 4 days per week. It's not like he's at a startup, like typing shit until his fingers bleed. He also had access to a department-issued truck for personal use and all the overtime he wanted. So with a great job and his fourth shot at a loving family, John decided to fill much of his spare time with something other than setting fires. He began writing a book called Points of Origin, Playing with Fire, about an arson investigator who was, as you might guess, also an arsonist. Oh, John. Yet the first rule of Casual Criminalist is don't write down your crimes. Even if you're doing it in a fictional context, John, just don't. Why are you doing this? While he never succeeded in selling his book, I can think of 12 people who would later have to read it. This kept him busy for a while. About by late 1990 and into early 1991, John had once again become bored. An unprecedented amount of fires began breaking out in the Los Angeles area. In the most severe case, 5 retail stores were set fire within a span of only 2.5 hours. The Los Angeles Arson Task Force joined forces with the ATF and the Fire Investigators Regional Strike Team, a team created by smaller towns surrounding LA that didn't have their own staff of arson investigators. This new team, nicknamed the Pillow Pyro Task Force, did not include John, not because he was under any suspicion yet, just as a matter of geography. But as far as I can tell, this was only the second time he wasn't the one investigating his own crimes, the first having been in Bakersfield. The Joint Task Force was aware of the similarities and modus operandi between these fires and the ones that had been set around the conventions the previous years, and they obtained a copy of the fingerprints that we discussed previously. On April the 17th, 1991, thanks to improvements in fingerprinting technology, this time they were able to identify the fingerprint as being an exact match of John's left ring finger. They really just screwed it up? That was not what I thought at all. I wouldn't expect that. Once they discovered that he was an arson investigator, their first instinct was to dismiss the fingerprint. It was probably just the result of improper handling of evidence. I mean, it's not like this guy was a real police officer, no matter how much he wanted to be, so he could be excused for accidentally touching the evidence while ungloved. But Captain Casey from Bakersfield shared with his team the suspicions that these fires were being set by an arson investigator, and so they decided to follow up and investigate John covertly. Smart move. Just do it quietly, because otherwise he'll be like, uh-oh, time to flee. Or at least it was supposed to be covertly. Oh no, a tracking device had been planted in his car, but it wasn't installed correctly. When John was leaving a fire conference in San Luis Obispo, California, the tracking device fell into plain view and he spotted it. Oh God, if you find that on your car, you're like, what is going on? Can you imagine finding a GPS tracker on your car that you didn't put there? That would be creepy as fuck. You'd be like, what is going on? I'd kind of be like, I hope it says police on it, because otherwise someone's tracking me and they're going to kill me. It's the Russians. Ah!
There are two different accounts of how he handled the situation. The first is that he did absolutely nothing, leaving the device in his car and never inquiring as to why he was being tracked. The second is that he thought it was a bomb and immediately took it to a police explosives range, where he was informed that by the task force that it was a hoax. Either way, he was unaware of a second properly installed tracking device that was planted in his car that November.
Yeah, I think if I was in that situation, I would probably put it back on the car. And then, like, I don't know. I don't know what I'd do next, but I'd definitely be like, okay, things have changed in my life.
After months of investigation, the new tracking device showed that John was present at another suspicious fire that had broken out. A federal grand jury indicted him on charges of arson, and on December 4th, 1991, he was finally arrested. During the routine search of his home, authorities found his 350-page manuscript for Points of Origin.
Main character's name? John.
I'm sure Simon said this when I brought up the book earlier, but do not write down your crimes, even if you think you can pass them as fiction. Just don't do it. Don't do it. It's a bad idea, always.
Points of Origin, playing with fire. To investigators, Points of Origin read like a combined diary and confession. There wasn't a lot of physical evidence to tie John to many of the fires that he had started, but there was that goddamn book. The arsonist in the book, Aaron Stiles, utilized the same incendiary device that John used. A group of matches affixed to a lit cigarette with a rubber band and wrapped in notebook paper. Now, you might be thinking that arson could have been inspired by the arsons that John investigated, and it was just an amalgam of his real-world experience. That's certainly what John attempted to argue. But 350 pages is a lot of pages, which meant there was a lot of detail about those events. Most notably, there was a description of one instance in which Aaron burned down a department store named Cal's, mirroring the fire that he had set at All's Home Center in South Pasadena. Not only did John describe a similar fire at a similar store with only a slightly changed name, but the fire in the alleged fictional story also claimed the lives of four people, including a grandmother and a two-year-old grandson. Again, you could try to argue that this was just drawing inspiration from real life, but there was one key detail that he needlessly added. In the book, John wrote that the grandmother had planned to take her grandson to get mint chocolate chip ice cream after they were done at the hardware store. That is a very specific detail, and one that turns out to be true of the real grandmother as well. I mean, you could still make the argument, and I have to say I do think there's reasonable doubt there, that yeah, of course he knew this and he just used it as a detail in his book. I definitely think there's still reasonable doubt, no? Just because that detail is correct. The only person who should have known this was the grandfather, who was also present at the fire but narrowly escaped with his life. He likely made the comment about it to bystanders while sobbing over the loss of his family, but it's not something that was reported in the media. Why would it be? Oh, God, I'm so small-brained. I thought maybe it was something that was in the report later on, that, you know, in an interview tape or something, that it heard. You know, it's like, oh, I was just taking my kid to get the mint chocolate chip cookies or something, and then that's in, you know, while he's talking to the police or the investigators afterwards. Oh, God, okay. Yeah, no, I see why. That's like definitely less reasonable doubt now. And even though John was one of the men who had investigated the fire, the arson investigation didn't take place until the following day, and there would be no reason for him to track down and interview the grandfather as a suspect. The only way he could have realistically known this detail is if he had been present at the fire to admire his handiwork. Just like with the real events, the allegedly fictional Aaron was outraged at the idea of the fire being not called arson. He loved the attention, and he hated that his work wasn't properly recognized. What about the people he'd murdered? Did Aaron have any thoughts on them? Yes, he did. In the book, John wrote, "The deaths were blotted out of his mind. It wasn't his fault. Just stupid people acting as stupid people do." I'm sure that's going to go over well with the jury. Oh my God. Yeah, also, your protagonist is not a protagonist. He's an antagonist. If your protagonist is like, "I like murdering people," that's not good. That's that dude. You need to go to jail for a long time. You need to go to jail forever. You killed a bunch of people. Are they going to execute you? It's California, right? Oh, they have it? I don't know. When was it? 1992? I feel like they do. They could execute him.
The trials. John would first go on trial in federal court in 1992 on 5 counts of arson. The defense rallied against the use of his fictional manuscript as a piece of evidence, citing the 1991 movie Backdraft that had been written by a firefighter. This went over about as well as you'd expect, even how detailed and incriminating John's confession was. Sorry.
I mean novel. On July the 31st, 1992, the jury finally finished their long deliberations. They found him guilty on 3 counts of arson and acquitted him of the other 2. The judge sentenced him to 30 years in prison, 10 for each count of arson, to run consecutively. But this was just the beginning of John's sentencing. I was like, wait, 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 where's the murder? Where's the murder? Despite maintaining his innocence, he pled guilty to 3 counts of arson on March the 24th, 1993. He took the plea deal because he couldn't afford to mount a reasonable defense and thought he had no chance at trial, which he probably didn't because it sure as hell seemed like he was guilty. Well, he's gonna get a public defender, though, for free, right? But he took the deal because it was rather beneficial to him. After being convicted on 3 counts of arson, he was sentenced to 30 years in prison. But by pleading guilty to 3 more, he'd only have to serve 10. What? I'm not sure adding more crimes can result in a lower sentence, but the deal was that if he pled guilty, he'd be eligible for parole in 2002. That's some nonsense right there. What sort of legal system is that? That makes no sense. What about all the murders? He arsoned people to death. 10 years in prison? He killed like 5 people or whatever. This is insanity. A minute ago I was talking about, is he going to get the death penalty or just prison forever? And he got paroled. John was paroled from federal prison in 2002. But that's only the federal charges. In 1994, the state of California indicted him on 21 more counts of arson, as well as 4 counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances. Here we go. When I first saw that phrase, I assumed that special circumstances was attached to murder, which meant it could be subject to a less severe penalty, but that's actually the complete opposite. The prosecutors are going after the death penalty. Oh, okay, so he was paroled from federal prison, which doesn't mean anything because he's just going to go to state prison, I guess, so he just has a little bit of change of scenery. The lead prosecutor offered John a deal to save his life. He would take the death penalty off the table, and all John had to do in exchange was confess to every single fire that had ever set since he was a child. He set a lot of fires. He's not remembering all of those. The deal was immediately rejected, and the decision was passed to a jury. After some deliberation, the jury convicted John on all 4 counts of murder and 20 of the 21 counts of arson. Oh, John, 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 you've made a tactical error. Death penalty's on the table, mate. The counts that they were deadlocked on was a fire that had been set on a Warner Brothers backlot that destroyed the original set of the show, The Waltons. That single charge was dismissed by the prosecution, so it was now time for sentencing. Throughout the entire trial, John had remained completely emotionless. If it wasn't clear, based on how he described the people he killed in his book, he had absolutely no remorse for any of his actions. He declined to testify, but his daughter Laurie testified on his behalf, pleading for his life. It was her testimony that spared John from the death penalty. On June the 25th, 1998, he was sentenced to 4 concurrent life sentences, plus an additional 21 years for the fires. After his parole from federal prison in 2002, he was transferred to state prison, where he was set to carry out the rest of his sentence. Although he did appeal and get some of the sentence vacated, it didn't make much difference, bro. You're in there for 4 life sentences in 21 years. You are never leaving jail. One of the fires John set had resulted in a massive blaze in the College Hill section of Glendale, a fire that completely destroyed 67 homes. The appeals court decided that because his intention was only to set a brush fire rather than to actually burn those homes down, and the end result was an accident, it would vacate 9 years of his sentence. Doesn't matter. I understand that a person's intention and mental state are important in determining the criminality of an action, but this seems like a weird ruling. John very intentionally started the fire, so I'm not sure it should matter that it became much larger than intended. Fortunately, his 4 life sentences were left untouched, so he's still in prison today, aged 73, or possibly 74, depending on when this episode airs. Searching for a motive. According to the ATF, from 1984 through 1991, John is believed to have set over 2,000 fires. This averages out to nearly 1 fire every day for 7 years. Supporting this idea is the fact that following his arrest, brush fires in the area decreased by over 90%. This only leaves the question of why. Why did John set so many fires? We don't actually have a concrete answer to this, particularly because he never admitted to setting any of them, despite his guilty plea and his convictions, unless you consider the book to be an admission, which would be pretty fair to do. John's behavior does not align well with the profile of other arsonists. Arsonists tend to be uneducated, antisocial, unemployed, unmarried, struggle with substance abuse, and suffer from specific other mental disorders. If he's not a typical arsonist, the obvious answer would be that he was a pyromaniac. It's what his defense in the federal case argued, claiming that he was so psychologically compelled to set fires that it was beyond his control. This is possible, but it's harder to say. Pyromania is a rare disorder, so rare that it hasn't actually been quantified. Even among repeat offenders of arson, pyromania was only present in about 3% of those studied. From what we know, John doesn't line up well with other pyromaniacs. Whether that's because he wasn't one or because they're so rare that our understanding of the disorder is incomplete is impossible to say. But his book does give us another, even rarer possible explanation, pyrophilia. Oh, is he getting turned on by fires? That's weird. It's definitely weird. Pyrophilia is a condition in which a person derives sexual gratification from starting fires and is so rare that spellcheck doesn't even acknowledge it as a word. That's not actually a great metric, but pyrophilia and pyromania are both so rare that it's statistically unlikely that even a single listener of this episode has either condition. Really? The case could be made that John was a pyrophiliac based on the way he described fire in his novel, which was very sexual in nature. The final possibility is that he just wanted attention and respect. All John wanted was to be a police officer, but he wasn't good enough. Even when he became an arson investigator and was thus theoretically a law enforcement officer, he still wanted more. It did help that the police were rude and condescending to him, but based on his behavior, any time he was given any sort of authority, their attitude towards him was probably justified. By committing arson, he was giving himself the opportunity to be a hero and win the respect of others. It's undoubtedly why he spent so much of his time doing interviews and writing for magazines. This does make a lot of sense as a motive, but there is a gaping hole in this logic. People love firefighters. The public's opinion towards police varies wildly depending on where you live and what decade it is, but a lot of people don't like, don't trust, or are afraid of cops. But respect and goodwill towards firefighters is almost universal. The only people that seem to hate firefighters are cops, and I'm pretty sure they only hate each other in the same way that the Army, Navy, and Air Force hate one another. Combine that with the fact that this was still all taking place in the Los Angeles area in the period leading up to Rodney King and the LA riots, there's no way that John would have been respected or appreciated by the public more by being a cop than a firefighter. But as logical and obvious as all that seems, people aren't always rational. Yeah, this would require a degree of rationality, which I don't think this guy has. While my personal best guess is that John's actions were the result of his insecurities over failing to become a police officer combined with pyrophilia, unless he actually decides to tell us, well, all we can do is speculate. It'd be like, John, you're in prison forever. Do you get it hard when you see a fire? Boom, just tell us, John. Just tell us. Wrap up. John continues to serve his sentence at California State Prison, where he should remain for the rest of his life, but he did finally get the attention he wanted. His story has been the subject of books, documentaries, and an HBO movie, Point of Origin, starring Ray Liotta as John. Yes, Ray Liotta from Goodfellas had nothing better to do in 2002 than make that terrible movie. John has also continued his writing while in jail, publishing several autobiographical accounts of his time while incarcerated. He also continued to show absolutely zero remorse for the lives that his fires claimed, as saying, "Those stupid people were acting as stupid people do." John's a bit of a psycho, really. Laurie, John's daughter, who staunchly believed in his innocence and saved his ass from execution, has since come around to the fact that her father is guilty. She cut off all ties with him and became a motivational speaker. While we joke about the rules for criminals on this channel, joke, Kevin, this is a practical guide. That's also a joke, by the way. We should be thankful that most criminals are too stupid to actually learn them. If it were not for John's manuscripts, there would be no evidence to tie him to the South Pasadena fire and the four murders. Even if all the other convictions were able to stick without his manuscript, it wouldn't have been enough. He was released from federal prison in 2002, and without the murder convictions, he would have been released from state prison in 2014. The 9 years between his release and now would have been enough for him to potentially set thousands of additional fires, destroying homes, businesses, and potentially claiming the lives of more innocent people. So thank you, John, for being a stupid person who wrote down your crimes. Don't write down your crimes. I mean, do write down your crimes, because then you're going to get caught. People definitely want to read that book, criminal. It's definitely, your next call you're going to get is going to be from Penguin. They're going to be like, we're publishing that. Your brilliant big brain is beautiful. No, the reality is it's just going to be read by 12 people in a jury box. Thank you, everybody, for watching, listening to this episode. I appreciate it. I appreciate you. I appreciate you, especially if you leave me a review, if you're a podcast person. That would be grand. And I'll see you in the next episode.